From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, Cecily Strong. She's nominated for an Emmy for her performances on Saturday Night Live. She's now starring in Schmigadoon, a loving satire of classic musicals filled with references to shows like Carousel, The Music Man, Oklahoma, and of course, Brigadoon. Strong and Keegan-Michael Key play a couple that gets lost in the woods and finds themselves mysteriously trapped in a town from the early 1900s where life is a musical. Schmigadoon was shot during the pandemic. It was a bright spot for Strong. Her new memoir is about the depression, anxiety, and grief she experienced during the first months of the pandemic. Later, Ken Tucker reviews a new album of songs Prince recorded in 2010. First News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Cecily Strong, is nominated for an Emmy for the second year in a row for her work on Saturday Night Live. She also stars on the new series Schmigadoon, which is a very smart, funny, and loving satire of musicals from the 40s and 50s. Strong joined SNL as a featured player in 2012. In her second season, she co-anchored Weekend Update with Seth Meyers and then Colin Jost. But she left the desk, preferring to do sketch comedy, which she's great at. Her characters have included Fox News host Judge Jeanine Pirro, Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, Melania Trump, and the girl you wish you hadn't started a conversation with at a party. Strong also has a new book that will be published tomorrow called This Will All Be Over Soon. It's a journal of her first year of the pandemic, dealing with anxiety and depression. Let's start with Schmigadoon, which is filled with references to classic musicals like Oklahoma, Carousel, The Music Man, The Sound of Music, and of course, Brigadoon. It's streaming on Apple TV+. Cecily Strong and Keegan-Michael Key star as a couple trying to reinvigorate their relationship by going on a hike designed for couples who need to reconnect. They get lost in the woods, cross over a bridge, and suddenly find themselves on what looks like a backlot movie set of a small town in the early 20th century, a town called Schmigadoon. The women are wearing long, colorful prairie dresses with big petticoats. The men are dressed like they're in old-fashioned barbershop quartets. The townspeople are singing and dancing as if they're in an old musical. Cecily Strong's character loves musicals and is initially charmed. Keegan-Michael Key's character hates musicals and is desperate to leave. But they both soon realize they're trapped in Schmigadoon, where life is a musical. A leprechaun has explained to the couple, in song, that they can't leave Schmigadoon until they find true love, which means the depth of their love is about to be tested. In this scene, the couple keeps trying to cross the bridge and escape Schmigadoon while bickering about their relationship.
I don't understand. Why couldn't we cross?
I mean...
What?
Look, this whole thing is insane. I'm still trying to wrap my head around all of it, but apparently, according to the leprechaun, this isn't true love.
So, you don't really love me?
I didn't say that. Of course I love you.
Then what are you saying?
I'm not saying anything, but apparently some cosmic verdict has been reached and we failed. That's all.
So you're ready to give up on us? Because of what a leprechaun said.
No, stop. I am just trying to figure out how to get out of here and get back to reality.
But not together.
We already tried together.
So what? Wait, you want to try with other people?
Oh, no. No. Please, no song. I'll do anything.
Guys, we're actually in the middle of something.
You can't plow a field without hitting some stones.
Every stake's bound to have some fat.
You can't eat a fish without getting some bones.
And you can't have love without having a lover's fat.
Would you leave us alone for just a minute?
Seriously, please.
First she says something bound to get his gander.
Then he says something mean to get her back.
Then she complains that he don't understand her.
And then he gives her a smack.
No, oh no, that's not okay. Unless it's consensual.
It's just a love.
Cecily Strong, welcome to Fresh Air. I love the show so much. It's brought me such pleasure at a time when I think we all need some pleasure. So how much do you love musicals?
Well, first of all, just thank you for saying that. I think there's nothing more thrilling than hearing Terry Gross likes your show and enjoys it and has joy from it. I'm also love the show and get a lot of joy from it. I've always loved musicals. I mean, I think it's certainly been a part of my life since I was little. You know, my grandmother would buy me musicals on VHS, and that's what I'd always rent whenever we go to the movie store. And then my uncle is also a Broadway producer, so I've gotten to see a lot of his shows in New York.
And he's not just a Broadway producer. He's like a really big Broadway producer.
Yes, thank you.
Like he, among the shows he did was terrific revivals of Music Man, which is, of course, referenced in Schmigadoon, and also a terrific revival of How to Succeed in Business, a Sondheim tribute. So you must have had this idea early on that being in shows was something real people did. I mean, when I was growing up in Brooklyn, I thought people in movies and on Broadway were like from another planet. Like they didn't connect to the world I lived in. They just performed, you know.
Sure. And I think you're probably not wrong. It feels like a little bit of other planet behavior, all of us. Yeah, I guess I knew it as a job. And I always wanted to be an actor since I was little. I think I took my first drama class when I was 3. What my parents put me in one, I should say. It's not like I drove myself, but I was just always performing around the house. And so I think they thought that might be a good outlet for me. And I wound up never stopping. And I think my uncle probably didn't want me to be an actor as much as I did, just knowing that it was a tough life.
Yeah, yeah. When you were going to see musicals that your uncle produced,
yeah,
did you get to meet the actors? Did you get to go backstage?
I did, and I mean, not always. I saw Guys and Dolls. I saw Once Upon a Mattress, which I absolutely loved and really wanted to do. But I certainly remember getting to go backstage after Secret Garden. And actually, my dad took a bunch of pictures. I met Daisy Egan, and my mom made a little poster for me for my room growing up that said Cecily on Broadway. And she used the playbill and a lot of those pictures. And I had that above my bed until we moved out, I think, till I went to college.
So your character in Schmigadoon is initially really charmed by the idea that they're like living in a world of a musical. And the first morning that you're there, you're having breakfast on the porch and you're being, you know, waited on by a very lovely, very young waitress. And she recommends the corn pudding. And you go like, whoa, what's that? And it's like, you don't know what corn pudding is? And so I want to play that scene because it'll give a sense of how people just kind of break out into song around you and how you sometimes just chime right in. And so we'll hear Cecily Strong doing a little solo in part of this as Keegan-Michael Key objects to her participation. So here's another scene from Schmigadoon.
They want us to take a verse.
I'm not singing, and you're not singing.
Come on, could be fun.
No, do not.
Never had corn pudding.
Why?
And it may be a waste, but if you've got some extra.
Extra?
I sure would like a taste.
Oh, she sure would like a taste.
That was so weird. It was like as soon as I started singing, I knew what to say.
That's fantastic. Can we please go now?
What? Why?
Are you serious? The entire town and you just spent the last 5 minutes singing about corn pudding.
Did somebody say corn pudding? Corn.
That's it. We're leaving.
Corn. Okay. Well, that one's on you.
That was another scene from Schmigadoon, which stars my guest Cecily Strong and Keegan-Michael Key. God, this whole musical is so much fun. It's such a contrast for me seeing the joy in Schmigadoon because everyone in it seems to be enjoying being in it so much, and I was enjoying watching it so much. And the contrast between that and the depression and anxiety you describe in your memoir, which a lot of your memoir is about, living through the pandemic, like the first almost year of the pandemic. And you shot Schmigadoon during the pandemic. What was it like for you to go from this heightened sense of anxiety and depression to flying to Vancouver? Was it Vancouver?
Yeah.
To shoot and be in these like exuberant, like joyful production scenes.
I said no, actually, at first, to going to Vancouver and shooting because I really was afraid. You know, and then it took a while to really understand, here's all of the things we're going to put in place, here's all the safety measures, until I finally felt safe. And then it was just such a gift. You know, it really, we talk about escapism, and I had real life escapism where I flew into this beautiful, magical land of Vancouver where there's like water and mountains and big trees. It was gorgeous. And then to be on those sets that were also gorgeous. And then to be with this amazing group of people, and we are able to do musicals in a time when Broadway is shuttered, and that's so depressing to walk next to. You know, there were a lot of tears on set, happy tears, just so much love and so much joy and such. We were all just so honored to be there, and it felt like we got to share this magical thing. And you know, everybody that was there was supposed to be there. It kind of felt like that a little bit. And I think a lot of that, you can feel it when you watch the show. And I think that's probably why I enjoy rewatching it so much, is just taking myself back there.
Had you been vaccinated when you shot the series?
No, because I mean, we shot in last fall, so that wasn't even, I didn't even know we'd get to be vaccinated. So we just were relying on testing.
Well, let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. If you're just joining us, my guest is Cecily Strong, and she stars in the new series Schmigadoon, which is a loving satire of classic musicals from the 40s and 50s. Her new memoir, This Will All Be Over Soon, will be published tomorrow. We'll be right back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to my interview with Cecily Strong. She's nominated for an Emmy for her work on Saturday Night Live. She has a new memoir called This Will All Be Over Soon. And she stars in the new series Schmigadoon, a satire of classic musicals from the 40s and 50s. I know from your new memoir that when Saturday Night Live did some episodes with everybody at home, that you didn't want to participate at first, and you didn't do one or two of the shows because you just didn't feel ready to perform, and because you really were in a serious state of depression and anxiety. What did it feel like to be honest and say, I'm not ready, I can't do it yet?
You know, luckily I have producers there and Lauren too, and I feel very taken care of by the show. It was only really one episode that I missed, and I really wanted to be there. And I think they knew that about me. It wasn't like I'm pulling out, I'm not going to do the show. It was like, in order to do the show next week, I just need to step away this week. You know, the first show we did the table read on Wednesday. And I think Hal Wilner, our music producer, had passed away the night before or something. And it was like, now we're seeing all of each other on Zoom at our first Zoom table read. And it was just so overwhelming and like, hi, I haven't seen you. Hi, how are you doing? Can you believe this, that we lost, you know? And it was like, now let's read our sketches and see, and then like have to film them all by Saturday. And so that's partly why I just wasn't even there. And I was like, I'd also kind of had a breakup kind of the night before. It was all just this crazy bad timing, but of course, like everything's bad timing over the past couple years or whatever. But then I did go back, and it was important to me, and it felt good to laugh, and it was a lot of work, which is a good distraction and good to like have a job again. And my roommates, my COVID roommates, Matt and Kevin, were helping me shoot everything, and we were making the sets and making our props and hair and makeup. So it was really, we had a fun little make-believe studio here.
And Hal Wilner, who you mentioned, he died of COVID. So that must have really kind of brought it home. And you had a boyfriend who got a bad case of COVID, but fortunately not bad enough to end up in the hospital. And he recovered. So like the reality, COVID was real to you. I mean, it's real to most people, but I mean, you saw the worst that could happen.
Right. And it's like this is still when New York City is really the epicenter, and our show is so about New York City. And
this was pretty early in the pandemic, right?
Right. Yeah. I think, you know, we were told, we went on our hiatus. That was supposed to be our 3-week or 2-week hiatus in March, and then just didn't come back until May.
You're nominated for an Emmy, second year in a row. That's pretty great. So let's talk a little bit about your work on Saturday Night Live. I think my favorite character that you've been doing lately is Judge Jeanine Pirro, the Fox News host. You just really got her down. Was it your idea to do her, or did someone say, oh, you should do her?
No, I think it was probably Brian Tucker, who I write with, and I wound up writing a lot of my update characters with him, or sort of those, anybody that's a real person. You know, I write Marjorie Taylor Greene with him, and we did Sidney Powell together this year, too. We were in his office, and he was like, have you seen this lady? And he was showing me clips of her, like, doing man on the street interviews. But she kept going, what? And it would like end in some crazy like exclamation. And we just thought it was so funny, and it was a fun way to play her. And we wrote a sketch actually that didn't make it onto the show. It went to dress and not to air. And then kind of like, well, I don't know that we'll ever get to do that again. It's hard. You have to do people that everybody knows. Otherwise, it's hard to get an impression on the show. Luckily for us, but maybe who knows for the greater world, someone else can judge, luckily or not. But she became more popular and more of a household name. So we did her on Update. And actually, I flew out of the chair the first time because, you know, I hadn't done much physical comedy on the show at all. So I really was like, come on, everybody, I have to practice this fall. And I was so, like, mad that no one was letting me have my rehearsal. Because at Update, you only get to rehearse on Saturday, really.
So let's hear a clip of you doing Jeanine Pirro. This was performed after Pirro made anti-Muslim remarks about Representative Ilhan Omar. So here you are on Weekend Update as Judge Jeanine Pirro.
Fox News personality Judge Jeanine Pirro returned to television tonight after being suspended 2 weeks for controversial comments about a Muslim congresswoman. Here to explain is Jeanine Pirro.
Jeanine Pirro, and it's up to you to decide just what my whole deal is.
That's great. So you're back on Fox.
That's right. This Mueller report completely exonerated the president, and therefore everybody on the Trump train. Woo, woo! So somebody at Fox News said my name into a bathroom mirror 3 times, and here I am. And Colin, I just want to take this opportunity to say hi to my super fans out there. Mean, horny men laying on in-home hospital beds and white prison gangs who control the remote on Saturdays. Thank you for watching.
Yeah, you know, I don't have to shout. You know, I can hear you.
Can't do it, pal. Mama's got one volume, and it's 3 Chardonnays deep at a crowded party.
That's Cecily Strong as Judge Jeanine Pirro. That's just so funny. What did you do to try to capture her voice?
We definitely loved the exclamations, you know, saving those for the what? And then just being loud and over-enunciating and trying to have a stern look. You know, she's always got a very gravely serious affectation.
there's times on Update when Colin Jost has been laughing like so hard because you're so funny. And is it hard for you to keep a straight face when he's having trouble keeping a straight face?
I almost enjoy it more to see when someone's laughing. Then I kind of want to like go further. And, you know, there's still an element of like you're playing with your friends. And it is, it still feels a bit like controlled chaos on Update, especially where it feels kind of fresh and we're not exactly sure what's going to happen. And so it makes me want to like poke harder. If I think that he's laughing at something, I want to hit that harder.
Well, let's take a break here and then we'll talk some more. If you're just joining us, my guest is Cecily Strong. She's nominated for an Emmy for her work on Saturday Night Live. She stars in the new series Schmigadoon that's streaming on Apple TV Plus, and she has a new memoir. We'll talk more after a break. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from the law firm Cooley LLP. With offices in the U.S., Europe, and Asia, Cooley advises entrepreneurs, investors, financial institutions, and established companies around the world, where innovation meets the law. And from Indeed, a hiring platform offering 135 skills tests to help businesses connect with candidates who align with their job requirements. Learn more at indeed.com/credit.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to my interview with Cecily Strong. She's nominated for an Emmy for her work on Saturday Night Live. She stars with Keegan-Michael Key in the new series Schmigadoon, about a couple who find themselves trapped in a small town from the early 1900s where life is a musical. The series is streaming on Apple TV+. Strong also has a new memoir called This Will All Be Over Soon. It's about her life during the first year of the pandemic, when she felt overcome by anxiety and depression. When we left off, we were talking about her characters on SNL. So I want to ask you about another character that you've done, and that's the girl you wish you hadn't started a conversation with at a party. Is that an idea that you originated?
Yes. It was my first year talking with Colin. You know, we were getting ready for one of those. I think there were two Update specials because it was an election year. And he was trying to help me find things. I was a new cast member and I was talking about something else. And then I sort of made fun of myself, like, yeah, because, you know, that's an important thing for society to hear or something. And then in making fun of myself, we sort of just kept playing with that, and that led into the girl you wish you hadn't started a conversation with at a party.
And who did you think of as being the girl?
Well, it was sort of a mix of, like, I'm making fun of myself, and then I'm thinking about people I'd seen on Facebook. And then I remembered, like, hearing my straight male friends talk about interactions that they'd had, like, with some girl that seems normal, and then it's like, oh, she just said something crazy, and how do I get out of this conversation?
Let's hear you as the girl you wish you hadn't started a conversation with at a party, and this is from the February 20th, 2017 edition of Saturday Night Live. We'll first hear the voice of Michael Che on Weekend Update.
With the election only 2 weeks away, both candidates are trying to get a final message out there to their supporters. Here with her final thoughts on this election is the girl you wish you hadn't started a conversation with at a party.
Wow. Hello, Michael Che. Thanks for finally letting a woman on late night TV.
So I assume you're not happy with the election.
Here's a thought, Michael. Maybe try being woke for a change, okay? Because Kevin can wait, but Syrian referees can't, okay? A newsflash, Michael. 40% of children are just their legs. And that's according to doctors, Michael Che.
Yeah, okay. Can you just please tell us about the candidates?
Please do not man-terrupt me when I'm making a point, Michael. This election is a disgrace, okay? This is a colostomy, Michael Che. And I'm sorry, if I can play devil's advocate for just a second, I think we all know the real reason Julian Assange is in jail, and that's because she's a woman. Do you even know what women have to do when we go vote, Michael? We have to show our IUD. I'm sorry, that's outrageous. That's called a double standard.
That's really funny. Talk about the process of writing that.
That's usually just Colin and I, and we both enjoy malapropisms, I think, as much as each other. So it's a lot of that. Like, what word, what is like a word that's in the social lexicon of the moment that this girl would hear and say wrong? And just like the idea, you know, that's like you can have so much passion and feelings about these things that you don't really understand and haven't given much thought to, and using them to sort of put down other people.
I love the way mansplaining becomes like, don't man-terrupt me.
Right.
That makes no sense at all.
No, she's taken all these concepts and just turned them into something confusing and wrong that she's very passionate about.
You did your first paid gig when you were 10. It was a McDonald's commercial that never aired. Do you remember it?
Yeah, absolutely, I do. I was licking a soft serve ice cream cone, and there was no lines. It was all facial expressions. I'm eating the ice cream, and the voiceover says, like, well, McDonald's now has ice soft serve for 37 cents or whatever it was. 37 cents, it must not be very good. Something that line. And then I made a face like, huh?
Were you thrilled to be doing a commercial?
Oh, totally. And I think, you know, getting that job is how I got into the union. So that's when I joined SAG.
When you were 10?
Yeah. I feel safer being a child actor in Chicago. You know, I was much more protected. I did a driver's ed video for the Wisconsin Department of Transportation. I did like a video for kids, for schools to show about kids with parents with drug and alcohol problems.
A turning point in your young life was in 1999 when you were a sophomore in high school. You were 15. You bought some weed with a friend, put it in your backpack. Then school security discovered the backpack, and you were actually handcuffed and arrested?
Yeah.
Would you describe that experience?
It was awful. Like, when I went to, they called me down to security to say they'd found my bag. So right away I was like, oh God. And then they kind of looked, they made like a show of it and looked in every pocket but that pocket and then said, okay, you're good to go. And they went, oh, wait a minute, there's one more pocket. And I'll never understand why they took joy in that, because it was such a huge and awful moment in my life. And like, we were ending someone's like educational career right now in this moment, and you're playing a game with it. Yeah, I got handcuffed and brought to a cop car and taken to the station. And I was really like a kid who sort of wanted to stay under the radar anyway. You know, I wasn't a super popular kid, and I did theater. And I loved school, so it was really tough being expelled. And even on the tape, like, they do your expulsion hearings, and they're taping it. And then he turns off the tape to say, like, oh, and off the record, you're a great student, and we're sorry to lose you.
That had to be off the record?
Yeah, exactly. That was my parents' question.
To make your point about being a good student, you were a National Merit Commended Scholar based on your PSATs. You not only, because you were expelled, you not only weren't allowed to attend the ceremony, you weren't allowed within a 3-block radius of where the ceremony was, and you were threatened with arrest if you overstepped that boundary. That strikes me as a little bit crazy. What is your critique of how the school and the police handled you?
Well, I actually will say the police had a program that I was really lucky to have. I mean, I got it expunged from my record by doing 100 hours of community service, and I wound up really loving the community service I did. I think with the school, this new superintendent came in and she made it her thing to have zero tolerance. And I was just part of a wave of kids who were expelled. I wound up being lucky and getting to go to the Catholic school I went to. And there's a bunch of kids who weren't as lucky as I was. And I think it's wrong to throw those kids out.
Well, in some ways, maybe it was a good thing because you ended up, after going to Catholic school, you ended up in a performing arts high school, which is where you really fit in.
Although I actually went back to public school, which was a tough decision, you know, whether to stay at the Catholic school or go back, because the rules of the expulsion or whatever, they let me back my junior year. But at that point, I think I started getting pretty depressed, and because of the time I missed, I don't have enough gym credits to graduate on time. And so it was like I was going to be a fifth-year senior, which just felt bonkers. You know, I was a straight-A student up until then. It just felt like I had fallen through the cracks, so I dropped out. And then we found the art school, and I wound up doing correspondence classes and graduating on time.
Oh, yeah, good. How did it affect your sense of self to be arrested and to be expelled and to think maybe you wouldn't even graduate high school?
I mean, I think I just felt smaller and smaller and smaller. You know, already I didn't feel like I fit in, and it was hard. You know, I had theater, thank God, and really was comfortable in that world. But to then think not only do I not fit in, I'm not welcome. And they've asked me to leave. And I'm a bad person. You know, to just not really know your place yet and then be told you don't have a place here, it just kind of, I felt like I didn't talk for a year or something.
Did you need therapy after that?
Oh, definitely. And I started, you know, I had to tell my mom, because there was a couple nights I shared a car with my brother at this time, and I would be driving home and I'd go, well, tonight I'll just keep driving west, right? Because, you know, every kid like wants to go to California. That's where everything's okay. It's like, I'll keep driving west, or I'll go to my garage and I will put on music I really like and get myself warm and fall asleep and not have to wake up. And it was like, I really was thinking about those two things as nice options, and had to tell my mom, and she was like, well, no, this isn't okay. And then I went to see the family psychiatrist who I loved, and she told me I was looking at the world with with crap colored glasses.
Were you surprised that you told your mother about how you were feeling and about having thoughts about suicide?
No, because it wasn't like they were not emotional thoughts. You know, it was sort of like in that robotic tone that you get kind of when you're depressed, when it's like, this is just the reality of this is what I want. So I don't know what you do with that. And I think because we'd already gone through things with my brother, so it wasn't like a big shock or anything I thought would, you know, that it was something she couldn't deal with.
He was dealing with a lot of mental health issues.
Right. And he, you know, he'd had depression for a long time. My brother actually did try to kill himself in eighth grade. I mean, he did a couple attempts here and there, but in eighth grade, he swallowed his bottle of Ritalin and had to get his stomach pump and was in the psych ward, the children's psych ward in Rush Hospital for a week. So it's like something my family had already been dealing with.
What was the impact of that on you?
It's hard to say, honestly. I mean, it's certainly stuck with me, and it's more than anything, it's like watching my brother deal with his own depression, and it's like how I feel about mine. Like, I'm so proud of the work I've done. I'm so proud of the work he's done and who he is and how far he's come and just the thing that he deals with and why I'm, you know, people have a lot of thoughts and opinions on psych meds and everything. I'm like, well, live with my brother for a week and tell me you don't think psych meds are good. Like, he's just, when he's managing it, he is the most delightful, wonderful. My brother's like one of my favorite people in the world. And so I think more than anything, it made me realize, like, that's what depression does to you. And it almost cost me my brother. And this is how important it is to manage it.
All right, let's take another break here. My guest is Cicely Strong, and she has a new memoir called This Will All Be Over Soon. She's now starring in the new series Schmigadoon, which is a loving satire of classic musicals from the 40s and 50s, and she's nominated for an Emmy for her work on Saturday Night Live. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for small and medium-sized businesses with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and mobility features to run their businesses from anywhere. More at OOMA.com. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to my interview with Cicely Strong. She's nominated for an Emmy for her work on Saturday Night Live. She has a new memoir called This Will All Be Over Soon. And she stars in the new series Schmigadoon, a satire of classic musicals from the 40s and 50s. Now that Delta is causing this resurgence, what's your level of anxiety now? And I should mention here that you bought a home in the Hudson Valley, which is outside of New York City. It's very beautiful there. It's on or near the Hudson River. I don't know exactly where you live. So you're not in the middle of New York City right now. You're in a safer place, safer in the sense that you can go outside without having to go down an elevator and walk through a lobby and be in the middle of Manhattan. Are you reverting to that level of fear again?
It's actually, funny timing. I feel like my bubble just burst recently. My mom is in Mexico and she's vaccinated and she just told me she's got COVID.
No.
And so I've
really?
Yeah. It's like I knew I was kind of, it wouldn't last the safety that I was feeling by being vaccinated. And then my bubble just burst. And I'm now back to worrying about someone I love with COVID and I can't, she's so far away. And I think she's doing well. And it seems like, you know, my other thought is like COVID is something we have to learn to coexist with. It's not something we're going to eradicate. And so it feels like breakthrough infections are going to be a part of all of our lives soon, too. So, but I definitely feel more anxious again.
Well, I hope your mom like recovers really soon. And
thank you.
I wish her the best. You're nominated for an Emmy for your work on SNL, and so are some of the other cast members. How does it feel? Do you feel like you're competing with other people who are nominated?
No, it feels great because this past year especially, I'm so proud of the show and being a part of the show. And I think, you know, whatever name is next to an Emmy or nomination, it still feels like everybody there is a part of that. Why there's a nomination. The reason there's a nomination is because it was a really strong year during a really tough time. And it wasn't easy to do this job this year. And so I'm so proud of everybody.
Reports are that you're not sure whether you're going back to SNL in the fall.
Right.
Have you decided?
I haven't. It's still, and I think, like, even though that seems crazy to say in the middle of summer, I think it's been a wild couple of years. And so I'm just, I'm okay with not knowing.
So when does the decision have to be made? I mean, the season starts, what, in late September usually?
Yes. So, I mean, I assume it'll have to be soon, and I'll meet, you know, I'll probably talk to Lauren more and talk to my agents, and we'll figure out where I'll be. So, you know, I would love to do it. It's so, I just don't know for sure yet.
Well, I wish you well. I wish your mother well.
Oh, thank you. I think she'll be so touched to hear that from you too. Again, my family, everyone I know, huge fans. So they'll be, I think that'll brighten her day.
Oh, that's nice of you to say. And anything I can do to to help would make me feel very, very good. And whatever you decide to do about Saturday Night Live, I wish you well.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Cecily Strong stars in the new series Schmigadoon, which is now streaming on Apple TV+. She's nominated for an Emmy for her work on Saturday Night Live. After we take a short break, Ken Tucker will review a new album of songs Prince recorded in 2010. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Prince died in 2016, but the Prince estate has opened its vault to release a completely new album recorded in 2010 called Welcome to America. It surprised early listeners with its numerous songs containing political messages, which was unusual for Prince. Rock critic Ken Tucker says the music speaks very much to the America of today.
Anybody close enough to hear knows what we've been listening to all year. These are the days my people told me to fear. But as long as I got your ear, I think it's gonna be hot summer. Just wait and see. Hot summer. Shoo-dee-doo-dee. Hot summer. As long as you're my company.
How wonderful it is to hear new Prince music. Especially something as warm and catchy and goofy as Hot Summer, complete with shooby-doobies in the refrain. It's one of the tossed-off pleasures of Welcome to America. Who knows why Prince opted to hide it away more than a decade ago, but this album's arrival now makes it sound very much of the moment.
We can live underwater. It ain't hard when you've never been apart. Of the country on dry land. We used to be smarter. We taught them what they know. And now we got to show them what it means to be American. Good life. Good life. Liberty. Innovation.
Innovation.
Every child, no matter what color, getting an education.
Education.
Now life in the hood is nothing to fear.
1,000 light years old.
About a peaceful
revolution. 1,000 light years away from me.
That's 1,000 light years from here. When he sings about being underwater, it's more than possible he was referring to the financial crisis of the years immediately preceding his 2010 recording date. But that song's lyrics about what it means to be an American ring out now with even more irony than Prince intended. The title song has his backup singers harmonize on the phrase, "Land of the free, home of the slave." And the third verse of "One Day We Will All Be Free" offers what could be heard now as Prince's take on critical race theory.
You go to school just to learn about what never existed. If your history only burns, it's better to resist it. Keeping it Franklin, Benjamin Banneker was never born a slave.
And if George Washington never told no lie, maybe we'd all be
political content in some of these songs is unusual in Prince's body of work, and it's important, therefore, to consider the context in which this music was made. Prince was recording these songs, skeptical of the possibility of social justice, during the first term of Barack Obama, which was a period filled with hope for the very citizens Prince frequently says here are being denied hope. This dubiousness on Prince's part reminds me of one of the few prominent black skeptics of Obama during this time, the public intellectual Dr. Cornel West, who in a funny way figures specifically in this album. People involved in the recording process have said Prince was in the habit of watching videos of Cornel West, who at one point in a speech said, "I love my brother Prince, but he's no Curtis Mayfield." Prince took this as a challenge, writing and recording Born to Die, with Prince offering Curtis Mayfield-style social commentary in a very Curtis Mayfield falsetto.
She sells everything, A to Z, anything just to keep her free from the hustle of the streets. She left the church a long time ago, said they couldn't teach what they did not know. That's when she lost her virginity. Now she's pimping every motto from New York to LA. Ask her why she do that thing. She says it's always been that way.
Always been that.
Jump back, Jack, you might be next if you try to cut mama's cake.
What the deal, Daddy?
And ask her what the deal is.
This is what she said.
In a way, Welcome to America is a perfect companion piece to Summer of Soul, Questlove's new documentary about a 1969 concert that encapsulated the whole of 60s rhythm and blues, reintroducing it to young folks in 2021. In a similar way, the inspirations for the songs on Welcome to America look back to older music that influenced Prince, while the lyrics look ahead to the future we inhabit now.
Ken Tucker reviewed the new posthumously released Prince album, Welcome to America. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, our guest will be Alexander Vindman, the Army officer who testified in Trump's first impeachment hearing. He'll talk about the impact on his career and family and why he says he would do it again. He has a new memoir called Here, Right Matters. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering today from Tina Calliquet. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, Henry Baldonado, Thea Challoner, Seth Kelly, and Kayla Lattimore. Our producer of digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
When she comes.
she never closes her eyes. No, no, no. She can see stars shoot. All over her sky.
Over and over and over.
Over and over. When she comes, she never ever
holds her side.
No, no. She can be suffering.
She can be
occasionally. She cries.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the NPR Wine Club, bringing the wine world to people's homes with stories on each bottle and wines inspired by NPR shows like Weekend Edition Merlot. Available to adults 21 years or older at nprwineclub.org. And from the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression.